Three tiny stars. On the radio, a man's calm voice interviewed people or reported news. When the words seemed to shift in meaning, she knew she had slept for a bit. "Yikes," she said softly at times. She thought about Christopher, why he would not let her come visit, why he did not come back east. Her mind briefly passed over the Larkins, wondering if they still visited their son. Perhaps Christopher stayed in California, hoping to reconcile with his wife. What a fierce know-it-all Suzanne had been. And yet she hadn't known a damn thing about any flower that grew up out of the earth. One freezing cold morning, Olive took her walk, went to Dunkin' Donuts, read the paper in the car while the dog in the back seat kept whining. "Hush," she said. "Stop it." The dog's whimpering became louder. "Stop it," she shouted. She drove. She drove to the library and didn't go in. Then she drove to the post office, tossed some junk mail into the waste bin, and then had to bend over and fish out a pale yellow envelope with no return address, the handwriting not one she recognized. In the car, she ripped it open. Just a plain yellow square. "He was always a nice man, and I'm sure he still is. Signed, Louise Larkin." The next morning, while it was still dark, Olive drove by the Larkin home slowly. There, beneath the blind, was the faintest strip of light. "Christopher," she said into the kitchen phone the next Saturday, "Louise Larkin sent me a note about your father." She heard nothing. "Are you still there?" she asked.
"Still here,"
Christopher said. "Did you hear what I said about Louise?"
"Yep."
"Don't you think that's interesting?"
"Not really."
Pain, like a pine cone unfolding, seemed to blossom beneath her breastbone. "I don't even know how she found out. Shut up in that house all day."
"Dunno,"
Christopher said. "All right, then," Olive said. "Well, I'm off to the library. Goodbye." She sat at the kitchen table, leaning forward, her hand on her big stomach. The thought that she could, any time she needed to, kill herself went through her head. It was not the first time in her life that she'd thought this, but before she would think about the note to leave. Now she thought she would leave no note, not even, "Christopher, what did I do that you should treat me this way?" She looked with some caution around the kitchen. There were women, widows, who hated to give up their home, died soon after someone hauled them off to assisted living. But she didn't know how long she could go on living here. She had been waiting to see if there was some way Henry could finally come home. She had been waiting for Christopher to come back east. As she stood up, looking for her car keys, because she had to get out of here, she remembered in a distant way how, as a much younger woman, she had felt the dreariness of domestic life, yelling while Christopher ducked his head, "I hate being a goddamn slave!" Maybe she hadn't yelled that. She called the dog and left. Absolutely stick-thin and appearing ancient in the way she moved, Louise led Olive into the darkened living room. Louise turned on a lamp, and Olive was surprised by the beauty in the woman's face. "Don't mean to stare," Olive said. She had to say this because she knew she was not going to be able to stop staring. "But you look lovely."
"Do I?"
Louise made a sound of soft laughter. "Your face."
"Oh."
It was as though all of Louise's earlier attempts to be pretty, her dyed blonde hair, her heavy pink lipstick, her eagerness of speech and careful clothing, the beads and bracelets and nice shoes, Olive remembered, all of this had, in fact, been covering up the essence of Louise, who, stripped by grief and isolation, and probably drugged to the gills, emerged in her frailty with a face of astonishing beauty. You seldom saw really beautiful old women, Olive thought. You saw the remnants of it, if they'd once been that way, but you seldom saw what she saw now, The brown eyes that shone with an otherworldliness sunken behind a bone structure as fine as any sculpture. The skin drawn tight across the cheekbones, the lips still full, her hair white and tied off to the side in a little brown ribbon.
I've made tea, Louise said.
No, but thank you.
All right, then.
Louise sat down gracefully in a chair nearby. She was wearing a long, dark green sweater-type robe. Cashmere, Olive realized. The Larkins were the only people in town with money they spent. The kids had gone to private school in Portland. They'd had tennis lessons and music lessons and skating lessons, and each summer had gone away to summer camp. People used to laugh about that because no other kid in Crosby, Maine, went to summer camp. There were summer camps nearby, filled with kids from New York. And why would the Larkins have their children spend the summer with them? It's how they were, is all. Roger's suits, Olive remembered, had been made by a tailor, or so Louise used to say. Later, of course, people assumed they must have gone broke. But maybe there weren't that many expenses once all the experts got paid. Olive looked around discreetly. The wallpaper had water stains in one spot, and the wainscoting was faded. It was clean, the room, but not one speck of effort had been given to maintaining it. Olive had not been here for ages. Perhaps a Christmas tea it had been. A Christmas tree in that corner, lit candles and food all over the place. Louise greeting people. Louise had always liked to present a good show.
It doesn't bother you, staying in this house? Olive asked.
Staying anywhere bothers me, Louise answered. To actually pack up and move, well, that's always seemed too much.
I guess I can see that.
Roger lives upstairs, Louise said, and I live downstairs.
Huh?
Olive was having trouble taking things in.
Arrangements get made in life. Accommodations get made.
Olive nodded. What she minded was how Henry had bought her those flowers, how she'd just stood there. She'd kept the flowers, dried them out, all the blue daisies brown now, bent over.
Has Christopher been a help to you? Louise asked. He was always such a sensitive boy, wasn't he?
Louise smoothed her bony hand over her cashmere-covered knee.
But then, Henry was a nice man, so that was lucky for you.
Olive didn't answer. Through the bottom of the drawn blind, a thin strip of white light shone. It was morning now. She'd be on her walk by the river if she hadn't come here.
Roger is not a nice man, you see, and that made all the difference.
Olive looked back at Louise.
He always seemed nice enough to me.
In truth, Olive didn't remember much about Roger. He had looked like a banker, which he was, and his suits had fit well, if you cared about that kind of thing, and Olive did not.
He seemed nice to everyone, Louise said. That's his modus operandi,
she laughed lightly.
But in reality,
she spoke with exaggerated enunciation,
his heart beats twice an hour.
Olive sat completely still, her big handbag on her lap.
Cold, cold man. Bah! But no one cares, because they blame the mother, you know. Always, 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 they blame the mother for everything.
I suppose that's true.
You know that's true. Please, Olive, make yourself comfortable.
Louise waved a thin white hand, a strip of poured milk in the dim light. Olive tentatively moved her handbag to the floor, sat back. Louise folded her hands and smiled.
Christopher was a sensitive boy, just like Doyle. Nobody believes this now, of course, but Doyle is the sweetest man alive.
Olive nodded, turned around, and looked behind her. 29 times the newspapers had kept reporting, and on TV, too. 29 times. That was a lot.
Maybe you don't like my comparing Doyle to Christopher.
Louise laughed lightly again, her tone almost flirtatious.
How's your daughter? Asked Olive, turning back to face Louise. What's she up to these days?
She lives in Boston, married to a lawyer, which has been helpful, naturally. She's a wonderful woman.
Olive nodded. Louise leaned forward, both hands on her lap. She tilted her head back and forth and chanted softly.
Boys go to Jupiter to get more stupider. Girls go to college to get more knowledge.
She laughed her soft laugh and sat back.
Roger ran right off to his lady friend in Bangor.
Again the soft laugh.
But she rejected him, poor thing.
For Olive, there was more than an inner silent groan of disappointment. There was an almost desperate urge to leave. And yet she could not, of course, having trespassed, having written Louise back, having asked to visit.
You've probably thought of killing yourself.
Louise said this serenely, as though discussing a recipe for lemon pie. Olive felt a sudden disorientation, as though a soccer ball had just been bounced off her head.
I hardly see that would solve anything, she said.
Of course it would,
Louise said pleasantly.
It would solve everything, but there's the question of how to do it.
Olive shifted her weight, touched her handbag that was next to her.
Myself, of course, it would be pills and drink. You, I don't see you as a pill person. Something more aggressive, the wrists, but that would take so long.
I guess that's enough of that, said Olive,
but she couldn't help adding,
there are people who depend on me, for heaven's sake.
Exactly.
Louise held up a bony finger, tilted her head.
Doyle lives for me, so I live for him. I write him every day. I visit every chance it's allowed. He knows he's not alone, and so I stay alive.
Olive nodded.
But surely Christopher doesn't depend on you. He has a wife.
She divorced him, Olive said.
It was odd how easy it was to say this. The truth was that she and Henry had never told anyone except their friends up the river, Bill and Bunny Newton. With Christopher in California, it didn't seem anyone needed to know.
I see, said Louise. Well, I'm sure he'll find a new one. And Henry doesn't depend on you, dear. He doesn't know where he is or who is with him.
Olive felt a shoot of fury stab through her.
How do you know that? It's not true. He knows damn well I'm there.
Oh, I don't think so. That's not what Mary says.
Mary who?
Louise put her fingers to her mouth in an exaggerated manner.
Whoops.
Olive felt a shoot of fury stab through her.
How do you know that? It's not true. He knows damn well I'm there.
Oh, I don't think so. That's not what Mary says.
Mary who?
Louise put her fingers to her mouth in an exaggerated manner.
Whoops.
Mary Blackwell? You're in touch with Mary Blackwell?
Mary and I go way back,
Louise explained.
Yeah, well, she told everyone things about you, too.
Olive's heart had started to beat fast.
And I imagine every one of them was true.
Louise laughed that soft laugh and made a gesture as though she were drying nail polish.
She shouldn't be telling things from the nursing home.
Oh, come now, Olive. People are people. It always seemed to me that you especially understood that.
A silence came into the room, like dark gases coming from the corners. There were no newspapers or magazines or any books.
What do you do all day? Olive asked. How do you manage?
Ah, said Louise, have you come here for lessons?
No, said Olive. I came here because you were nice enough to write me a note.
I was always sorry my kids didn't have you for a teacher. So many people don't have that spark, do they, Olive? Are you sure you wouldn't like that tea? I'm going to have some.
No, I'm fine. Olive watched as Louise stood and moved through the room. Louise bent to straighten a lampshade, and the sweater fell across her back, showing the thin form of it. Olive didn't know you could be that thin and still be alive.
Are you ill?
She asked when Louise returned with a teacup on a saucer.
Ill?
Louise smiled in that way that reminded Olive once again of flirtation.
In what way ill, Olive?
Physically. You're very thin, but you certainly do look beautiful.
Louise spoke carefully, but again with that playful tone.
Physically ill I am not, though I have little appetite for food, if that's what you're referring to.
Olive nodded. If she had asked for tea, she'd have been able to leave when she'd finished it, but it was too late now. She sat.
And mentally, I don't believe really that I am one bit more out of my head than any other creature here on earth.
Louise sipped her tea. The veins on her hand were pronounced. One went right down her skinny finger. The teacup clattered just slightly against the saucer.
Has Christopher been out here frequently to help you, Olive?
Oh, sure. Sure he has.
Louise pursed her lips, tilted her head again, studied Olive, and Olive could now see that the woman was wearing makeup. Around her eyes was a shadowing of color that matched her sweater.
Why did you come here, Olive?
I told you, because you were nice enough to send that note.
But I've disappointed you, haven't I?
Certainly not.
You're the last person I expected to lie, Olive.
Olive reached down for her handbag. I'm going to get going, but I do appreciate that you sent the note.
Oh, said Louise, laughing softly. You came here for a nice dose of Schadenfreude, and it didn't work, she sang. Sorry.
Overhead, Olive heard the floorboards creak. She stood, holding her bag, looking for her coat.
Roger is up.
Louise continued her smile.
Your coat is in the closet right as you come in, and I happen to know that Christopher has been back only once. Liar, liar, Olive! Pants on fire, Olive!
Olive went as fast as she could. She had the coat over her shoulder and turned back briefly. Louise was sitting in her chair, her thin back straight, her face so oddly beautiful. She was no longer smiling. She said to Olive loudly,
"She was a bitch, you know, a slut."
"Who?"
Louise just stared at her with stony beauty. A shiver ran right through Olive. Louise said,
She was something, let me tell you, Olive Kittredge. A cocktease. I don't care what the papers said about how she loved animals and small children. She was evil, a living monster brought into this world to make a sweet boy crazy.
Okay, okay.
Olive was putting her coat on hurriedly.
She deserved it, you know. She did.
Olive turned and saw Roger Larkin on the stairs behind her. He looked old and wore a loose sweater. He had slippers on. Olive said, "I'm sorry, I've disturbed her."
He only raised a hand tiredly, the gesture indicating that she was not to worry. Life had brought them to this point, and he was resigned to living in hell. This is what Olive thought she saw as she hurried to get her coat on. Roger Larkin opened the door, nodding slightly. And as the door was closing behind her, Olive was certain she heard the tiny, quick, smashing sound of glass and the spat-out word, "Cunt!" A bright haze hung over the river, so you could barely make out the water. You couldn't even see too far ahead on the path, and Olive was consistently startled by the people who passed by her. She was here later than usual, and more people were out and about. Next to the asphalt pathway, the patches of pine needles were visible, and the fringe of tall grasses and the bark of the shrub oaks, the granite bench to sit on. A young man ran toward her, emerging through the light fog. He was pushing before him a triangular-shaped stroller on wheels, the handles like those of a bicycle. Olive caught sight of a sleeping baby tucked inside. What contraptions they had these days, these self-important baby boomer parents. When Christopher was the age of that baby, she'd leave him napping in his crib and go down the road to visit Betty Sims, who had 5 kids of her own. They'd be crawling all over the house and all over Betty, like slugs stuck to her. Sometimes when Olive got back, Chris would be awake and whimpering, but the dog, Sparky, knew to watch over him. Olive walked quickly. It was unseasonably hot, and the haze was warm and sticky. She felt the sweat run from below her eyes like tears. The visit to the Larkin home sat inside her like a dark, messy injection of sludge spreading throughout her body. Only telling someone about it would get it hosed out, but it was too early to call Bunny, and not having Henry, the walking, talking Henry, to tell this to, grieved her so much that it was as though she had just that morning lost him to his stroke again. She could picture clearly what Henry would say, always that gentle amazement.
"My word," he'd say softly. "My word."
"On your left," yelled someone, and a bicycle whizzed past her, coming so close she felt the whir of air on her hand.
"Jesus, lady," said the helmeted alien as he sped by, and confusion rolled through Olive.
"You're supposed to stay on the right side of the line," came a voice from behind her, a young woman on rollerblades. Her voice was not angry, but it was not kind. Olive turned and walked back to her car. At the nursing home, Henry was asleep. With one cheek against the pillow, he looked almost the way he used to look, because his eyes were closed and the blindness was taken away, so the blank, smiling face was gone. Asleep, with the faintest furrowing of his brows, a hint of anxiety seemed caught within him, making him familiar. Mary Blackwell was nowhere in sight, but an aide told Olive that Henry had had a bad night.
"What do you mean?" Olive demanded.
"Agitated. We gave him a pill around 4 this morning. He'll probably sleep a while longer."
Olive pulled the chair next to the bed and sat holding his hand beneath the guardrail. It was still a beautiful hand, large, perfectly proportioned. Surely as a pharmacist all those years while he counted out pills, people watching had trusted those hands. Now his handsome hand was the hand of a man half dead. He had dreaded this, as all people did. Why it should have been his fate and not, for example, Louise Larkin's, was anyone's guess. The doctor's guess was that Henry should have been on Lipitor or some other statin, since his cholesterol had been a little high. Henry had been one of those pharmacists, though, who seldom took a pill, and Olive's feeling about the doctor was simple. He could go to hell. She waited now until Henry woke up so he wouldn't wonder where she was. When she tried to wash him, get him dressed with the help of the aide, he was groggy and heavy and kept falling back asleep. The aide said,
"Maybe we should let him rest for a bit."
Olive whispered to Henry,
"I'll be back this afternoon."
No one answered the telephone when she called Bunny. She called Christopher. With the time difference, he'd be getting ready for work.
"Is he okay?"
Christopher asked immediately.
"He had a bad night. I'll go back up in a while. But, Chris, I saw Louise Larkin this morning."
He made no response the whole time she talked. She could hear an urgency in her voice, something desperate or defensive.
"The crazy creature suggested I cut my wrists," Olive said. "Can you imagine that? And then said, well, maybe that would take too long."
Christopher remained silent, even when she finished with the smashed teacup and the name-calling. "Bitch." She could not bring herself to say the word cunt.
Are you there? She asked sharply.
I can't imagine why you went to see her,
Chris finally said, as though accusing her of something.
After all these years, you never even liked her.
She sent that note, Olive said. She was reaching out.
So what?
Said Christopher.
You couldn't drag me in there to save my life.
It would hardly save your life. She's all ready to stab someone herself, and she said she knows you've only come back here once.
How would she know that? I think she's cracked.
She is cracked. Haven't you been listening? But I think she knows that from Mary Blackwell. Apparently they're in touch.
Christopher yawned.
I have to get into the shower, Mom. Just let me know if Daddy's all right.
As she drove to the nursing home, a light rain dropped onto the car and onto the road before her. The sky was gray and low. She felt an upset different from the times before. It stemmed from Christopher, yes, but she seemed caught between the pincers of some intractable remorse. A personal, deep embarrassment flushed through her, as though she had been caught in the act of shoplifting, which she had never done. It was shame that swiped across her soul, like these windshield wipers before her. Two large, black, long fingers, relentless and rhythmic in their chastisement. Pulling into the parking lot of the nursing home, she turned the car too sharply and came close to hitting a car pulling in beside her. She backed up, pulled in again, leaving more space, but she was unsettled by how close she had come to hitting the car. She took her big handbag, made sure to put her keys where she could find them, and stepped out. The woman, she was ahead of Olive, started to turn toward her, and in less than a few seconds, a strange thing happened. Olive said, "I'm awfully sorry about that. My gosh." Just as the woman said, "Oh, that's all right," with a kindness that Olive felt was providential in its spontaneous generosity. The woman was Mary Blackwell, and the moment occurred so suddenly that neither woman seemed to know at first who the other was. But there they were, Olive Kittredge apologizing to Mary Blackwell, and Mary's face, kind, gentle, absolutely forgiving.
"I just didn't see you there with this rain, I guess," Olive said.
"Oh, I know. It can be bad, this kind of day. Twilight before it even gets going."
Mary held the door open for her, and Olive passed in front of her.
"Thank you," Olive said.
Just to make sure, she glanced at Mary, and the woman's face was tired and non-combative, the remains of sympathy still there. It was like a sheet of paper on which marks of something simple and honest had been drawn. Who did I think she was? Thought Olive. And then, who do I think I was?
Henry was still in bed. He had not made it into his chair all day.
She sat by him, touching his hand, and fed him some mashed potato, which he ate. It was dark as she prepared to leave. Waiting until she knew she would not be interrupted, she leaned over to Henry and whispered right into his ear,
"You can die now, Henry. Go ahead. I'm fine. You can go ahead. It's all right."
She did not look back as she left the room. Dozing in the bump-out room, she expected the phone to ring. In the morning, Henry was in his wheelchair, a polite smile on his face, his eyes unseeing. At 4 o'clock, she returned and spooned into his mouth his supper. The next week was the same, and the week after that, autumn was upon them. Soon it would be dark as she fed him his supper from the tray that sometimes Mary Blackwell brought. One evening when she returned home, she looked through a drawer of old photographs. Her mother, plump and smiling, but still foreboding. Her father, tall, stoic. His silence in life seemed right there in the photo. He was, she thought, the biggest mystery of all. A picture of Henry as a small child, huge-eyed and curly-haired. He was looking at the photographer, his mother, with a child's fear and wonder. Another photo of him in the Navy, tall and thin. Just a kid, really, waiting for life to begin. You will marry a beast and love her, Olive thought. You will have a son and love him. You will be endlessly kind to townspeople as they come to you for medicine, tall in your white lab coat. You will end your days blind and mute in a wheelchair. That will be your life. Olive slipped the picture back into the drawer, her eye catching a photo of Christopher, taken when he was not yet two. She had forgotten how angelic he'd looked, like some creature newly hatched, as though he had not yet grown a skin and was all light and luminescence. You will marry a beast, and she will leave you, Olive thought. You will move across the country and break your mother's heart. She closed the drawer. But you will not stab a woman 29 times. She went into the bump-out room, lay down on her back. No, Christopher wouldn't stab someone. She hoped not. It was not in his cards, not in his bulb, planted in this particular soil, hers and Henry's, and their parents before them. Closing her eyes, she thought of soil and green things growing, and the soccer field by the school came into her mind. She remembered the days when she was a schoolteacher, how Henry would leave the pharmacy sometimes in the autumn to come and watch the soccer games on the field beside the school. Christopher, never physically aggressive, had spent most of the games sitting on the bench in his uniform, but Olive had suspected he didn't mind. There was beauty to that autumn air, and the sweaty young bodies that had mud on their legs, strong young men who would throw themselves forward to have the ball smack against their foreheads, the cheering when a goal was scored, the goalie sinking to his knees. There were days, she could remember this, when Henry would hold her hand as they walked home, middle-aged people in their prime. Had they known at these moments to be quietly joyful? Most likely not. People mostly did not know enough when they were living life that they were living it. But she had that memory now of something healthy and pure. Maybe it was the purest she had, those moments on the soccer field, because she had other memories that were not pure. Doyle Larkin had not been at the soccer games. He had not gone to that school. Whether Doyle even played soccer, Olive didn't know. She could not recall Louise ever saying, "I must go to Portland this afternoon to see Doyle in a soccer game." But Louise had loved her children, had bragged about them endlessly. When she'd spoken of Doyle being homesick at summer camp, her eyes had moistened. Olive now remembered this. There was no understanding any of it. But she had been wrong to visit Louise Larkin, hoping to feel better by knowing the woman suffered. It was ludicrous as well to think that Henry would die because she had told him he could. Who in the world, this strange and incomprehensible world, did she think she was? Olive turned onto her side, drew her knees up to her chest, turned on her transistor radio. She would have to decide soon whether or not to plant the tulips before the ground was frozen. Basket of Trips. Town is the church and the Grange Hall and the grocery store, and these days the grocery store could use a coat of paint. But no one's about to mention that to the grocer's wife, a plump, short woman who has brown eyes and two little dimples high up on her cheeks. When she was younger, Marlene Bonney was quite shy, and she would push the numbers on the cash register with a tentativeness, patches of pink spreading over her cheeks. You could see it made her nervous, counting out the change. But she was kind and warm-natured, and would listen carefully, her head bent forward, whenever a customer mentioned a problem they had. The fisherman liked her because she was quick to laugh, a sweet eruption of a deep, soft giggle. And when she made a mistake with the change, as she sometimes did, she would laugh even while blushing clear to her roots. "I guess I'm not going to win any prizes," she'd say. "No prizes for me." Now, on this April day, people stand in the gravelly parking lot next to the church, waiting for Marlene to come out with her kids. Those who speak do so quietly, and there is a great deal of abstracted gazing, not uncommon in these circumstances, and many long glances at the ground. This same gravel parking lot stretches along the road and goes eventually up to the big side door of the grocery store, which in the past was often open during the summer months, and where people could see Marlene out back there playing cards with the kids or fixing them hot dogs to eat. Good kids, always running around the store when they were small, always underfoot. Molly Collins, standing next to Olive Kittredge, both of them waiting along with the rest, has just looked around behind her at that side of the grocery store, and with a deep sigh says, "Such a nice woman. It isn't right." Olive Kittredge, who is big-boned and taller by a head than Molly, reaches into her handbag for her sunglasses, and once she has them on, she squints hard at Molly Collins because it seems such a stupid thing to say. Stupid, this assumption people have that things should somehow be right. But she finally answers, "She's a nice woman, it's true." Turning and looking across the road at the budded forsythia near the Grange Hall. And it is true, Marlene Bonney is sweet, and as thick as molasses to boot. Years ago, it was Olive who taught Marlene math in the 7th grade. Olive thinks she knows better than most how hard it must have been for the poor girl to take on that cash register when the time came. Still, the reason Olive has come here today, volunteered to help out, is that she knows Henry would be here if things weren't as they are. Henry, who went to church every Sunday, believed in this community stuff. But there they are. Marlene has come out of the church, Eddie Jr. next to her, and the girls right behind. Marlene has been crying, of course, but she is smiling now, the dimples high on her cheeks twinkling as she thanks people, standing on the side porch of the church in a blue coat that spreads over her rounded behind, but is not long enough to cover the rest of the green-flowered dress that sticks to her nylons with static cling. Carrie Monroe, one of Marlene's cousins, who was in trouble with the law a few years ago, and Marlene helped her out, took her in, gave her a job at the store, stands behind Marlene, slick as a whistle with her black hair and black suit and sunglasses, giving a nod to Eddie Jr., who nudges his mother toward a car and helps her get in. Those people going to the cemetery, and this includes the husband of Molly Collins, get into their cars as well, switching on their headlights in the midst of this sunny day, waiting for the hearse to pull away, then for the black car carrying the rest of the Bonnies to follow. All of it costing an arm and a leg, Olive thinks, walking to her own car along with Molly.
"Direct cremation," Olive says, as she waits for Molly to dig out a seatbelt from the mess of dog hairs. "No frills. Door to door. They'll come right down from Belfast and take you away."
"What are you talking about?" Molly turns her head toward Olive, and Olive can smell the woman's breath from those false teeth she's had for years.
"They don't advertise," Olive says. "No frills. I told Henry that's the outfit we'll be using when the time comes."
She pulls out of the parking lot and starts down the road toward the Bonnie's house, which is way down at the end of the point. She has offered to go back with Molly to help lay out the sandwiches, avoiding, that way, the cemetery. The lowering of the casket and all that business she can do without.
"Well, it's a nice day, anyway," says Molly, as they pass the Bullock place on the corner. "Helps a little bit, I think."
And it's true the sun is strong, the sky very blue behind the Bullock's red barn.
"Is Henry able to understand, then?" Molly asks a few minutes later. For Olive, this is like someone has swung a lobster buoy and slammed her in the breastbone, but she answers simply,
"Some days, I think so, yes."
Lying is not what makes her angry, it's the question that has somehow made her angry, and yet she also has an urge to tell this woman sitting stupidly beside her how she took the dog over last week on that day the weather was so warm, how she brought Henry out to the parking lot, and the dog licked his hands.
"I don't know how you do it," Molly says quietly,
going there every day, Olive. You're a saint.
I'm hardly a saint, and you know it, Olive answers, but she is so angry she could drive right off the road.
I wonder what Marlene is going to do for money, says Molly. Do you mind if I open a window?
I think you are a saint, Olive, but no offense, it smells a little doggy in here.
Offense is not taken, I assure you, says Olive. Open any windows you like.
She has turned onto Eldridge Road, and this is a mistake because now she will have to drive by the house where her son Christopher used to live. She almost always makes a point of going the other way, taking the old route down to the bay. But here she is, and now she prepares herself to turn her head away, feigning nonchalance.
Life insurance, Molly is saying. Cousin Carrie? She told someone there was life insurance, and I guess Marlene's also thinking of selling the store. Apparently, Carrie's the one who's been running the business this year.
Olive's eye has caught the clutter of cars in the front yard, and she turns her head as though to glance through the spruce trees out to the water. But the afterimage of the junky front yard remains in her eye, and oh, it had been a beautiful place. The lilac by the back door would have its tight little buds now, the forsythia at the kitchen window probably ready to burst, if those beastly people haven't knocked it down, living there like pigs. Why buy a beautiful house and junk it up with broken cars and tricycles and plastic swimming pools and swing sets? Why do a thing like that? As they come over the crest, where only juniper bushes and blueberry bushes grow, the sun is so bright above the water that Olive has to put the sun visor down. They pass by Moody's Marina, down into the little gully where the Bonnie house is.
Hope I haven't lost the key she gave me, says Molly Collins, fishing through her handbag. She holds up a key as the car stops. Pull up a little farther there, Olive. There'll be a lot of cars here when they get back from the cemetery.
Years ago, Molly Collins taught home ec at the same school where Olive taught math, and even back then she was a bossy thing. But Olive pulls the car up farther.
She probably ought to sell the store, says Molly as they walk around to the side door of the Bonnie's big old house. Why bother with the headache of all that if she doesn't need to?
Inside, standing in the kitchen looking around, Molly muses,
maybe she ought to sell this place, too.
Olive, having never been inside before, thinks the place looks tired. It's not just because some tiles are missing from the floor by the stove, or that part of the counter has bubbled up along the edge. The place simply has an air of exhaustion. Dying. Not dying. Either way, it tires you out. Olive peeks into the living room, where a large window looks over the ocean. It is a lot to take care of. On the other hand, it's Marlene's home. Of course, if Marlene sells the place, then Carrie, who lives in the room above the garage, will have to move out as well. Too bad, Olive thinks, closing the closet door with their coats hung up, heading back into the kitchen. Carrie Monroe had her eye on Christopher a few years back, smelled some money in that practice of his. Even Henry felt compelled to tell him to watch out. Don't worry, Christopher said, she's not my type, which is pretty funny to think of now.
You could laugh your head off with that one. Ha, ha, thud, says Olive to no one as she comes into the kitchen, knocks her knuckles a few times on the table. Put me to work, Molly.
See if there's any milk in the refrigerator and pour it into these creamers.
Molly is wearing a bib apron that she must have found here in the kitchen somewhere, or maybe she brought it along. One way or another, she appears to have made herself at home.
Now, Olive, tell me. I've been wanting to ask. How is Christopher these days?
Molly sets out plates on the table as quick as playing cards.
He's fine, says Olive. Now, what else do you want me to do?
Arrange these brownies on this. He likes it out there in California.
He's very happy out there. Got a nice practice going.
Little tiny brownies. What was wrong with making a brownie big enough to sink your teeth into? How can people in California have problems with their feet? Asks Molly, moving around Olive with a plate of sandwiches. Don't they drive everywhere? Olive has to actually look at the wall and roll her eyes because of how stupid this woman can be.
But feet they have, and Chris has a very nice practice. Any grandchildren on the way?
Molly draws the words out with a kind of coyness while she shakes sugar cubes into a little bowl.
Haven't heard, says Olive, and I don't believe in asking.
She takes one of the little brownies and puts it into her mouth, making her eyes big at Molly. Olive and Henry had told no one except their old friends Bill and Bunny Newton, who lived 2 hours away, that Christopher was now divorced. Why tell anyone that? It was nobody's business, and Christopher living so far away, who needed to know that his new wife had walked out after moving him across the country, and that he didn't want to come home? No wonder Henry had a stroke. How unbelievable it was. Never in 100 years would Olive tell Molly Collins or anyone else how terrible it was when Christopher came back to visit his father in the nursing home. How terse he was with her. How he went back early. This man who was her dearly loved son. A woman, even Marlene Bonney's age, could expect one day to outlive her husband. A woman could even expect her husband to get old and have a stroke and stay slumped in a chair at a nursing home. But a woman did not expect to raise a son, help him build a lovely house nearby, get started in a steady podiatry business, then have him marry and move across the country and never move home again, even when he found himself deserted by a beast of a wife. No woman, no mother, expected that. To have a son stolen away.
Leave enough for others, Olive, says Molly Collins, and then,
well, at least Marlene has her kids. Wonderful kids they are, too.
Olive takes another brownie and puts it into her mouth, but then here they are, the kids themselves, coming through the back door with Marlene, moving through the kitchen as the sound of cars pulling into the gravel alongside the driveway can be heard, and then doors slamming shut, and Marlene Bonney herself standing now in the hallway, holding her pocketbook slightly up and away from her body as though the pocketbook belongs to someone else, standing there until someone leads her into the living room, where she sits down politely on her own couch.
We were just saying, Molly Collins says to her, that honestly, Marlene, you and Ed turned out the 3 best kids in town.
And it's true, they are something to be proud of. Eddie Jr. in the Coast Guard, smart the way his father was, although he is not as outgoing, there is a wariness in his dark eyes. Leanne studying to be a nurse. Cheryl about to graduate from high school. You never heard about any trouble they were in. But Marlene says,
oh, there's lots of nice kids around.
Taking the coffee that Molly hands her, Marlene's brown eyes seem a little out of focus, the flesh of her cheeks a little more droopy. Olive sits down in a chair across from her.
That cemetery stuff's bad business, Olive says,
and Marlene smiles, her dimples twinkling like tiny imprints of stars high up on her cheeks.
Oh, hello, Olive, she says.
It has taken Marlene years to stop calling her Mrs. Kittredge, which is what happens when you have people in school. And of course, the opposite is true, which is that Olive continues to see half the town as kids, as she can still see Ed Bonney and Marlene Monroe as young school kids, falling in love, walking home day after day from school. When they reached the Crossbow Corners, they would stand and talk, and sometimes Olive would see them there as late as 5 o'clock, because Marlene had to go one way and Ed the other. Tears have appeared in Marlene's eyes, and she blinks fast. She leans toward Olive and whispers,
Carrie says nobody likes a crybaby.
Hell's bells, answers Olive.
But Marlene sits back as Carrie appears, stick thin and high-heeled, thrusting out that black-suited pelvic bone as soon as she stops walking, and it crosses Olive's mind, suddenly,
that maybe Carrie was bullied when she was very young. Skinny little kid. Carrie asks, "You want a beer, Marlene, instead of that coffee?" She's holding a beer herself, her elbow tucked to her waist, and her dark eyes are keen, taking it in, the still full cup of coffee in Marlene's hand, and the presence of Olive Kittredge, too, who years ago sent Carrie to the principal's office more than once before Carrie got shipped off to live with relatives somewhere. "Or would you like a little whiskey?" Henry might have remembered why they sent the girl away. Olive has never been one for remembering things.
"A drop of whiskey sounds good," says Marlene. "You want any, Olive?"
"Nope, thanks." If she drank, she'd be a guzzler. She stays away from it, always has. She wonders if Christopher's ex-wife might have been a secret guzzler out there drinking all that California wine. The house is filling up. People move down the hallway and out onto the front porch. Some of the fishermen have come over from Sabattis Cove, all scrubbed-looking, their big shoulders slumped. They seem sheepish, apologetic, as they move into the living room, taking the tiny brownies with their big hands. Soon the living room is so full that Olive can no longer see out to the water. People's skirts, belt buckles move past her.
"I just wanted to say, Marlene."
And here, in a sudden clearing of people, is Susie Bradford, pushing herself between the coffee table and the couch.
"That he was so brave during his sickness. I never saw him complain."
"No,"
says Marlene,
"he didn't complain."
And then,
"he had his basket of trips."
At least that's what Olive thinks she's heard. Whatever Marlene has said seems to embarrass her. Olive sees the woman's cheeks flush as though she has just divulged some private, very intimate secret that she shared with her husband. But Susie Bradford has spilled jelly from one of the cookies down her front, and now Marlene is saying,
"Oh, Susie, go into the bathroom down the hall. Such a pretty blouse. What a shame."
"No ashtrays in this house," says a woman on her way past Olive. And because of a little crush of people, the woman has to stand there in front of Olive for a moment. She takes a deep drag from her cigarette, squinting her eyes against the smoke. Some tiny ping of recognition, of knowledge, takes place in Olive. But she could not tell you who this woman is. She knows only that she doesn't like the looks of her, with her long, stringy hair that contains a lot of unflattering gray. Olive thinks when your hair gets gray, it's time to chop it off or pin it up on top of your head. No point in thinking you're still a schoolgirl.
"I can't find an ashtray in this house," the woman says, tilting her face up quickly as she breathes out a stream of smoke.
"Well," says Olive, "I guess that's too bad." And the woman moves away. The couch comes into view again. Carrie Monroe is drinking a tumbler of brown stuff, the whiskey she was offering earlier, Olive suspects, and while Carrie's lipstick remains bright, her cheekbones and jawline still impressively proportioned, it's as though inside her black clothes her joints have become loosened, her crossed leg swings, a foot bobs, some inner wobbliness is there.
"Nice service, Marlene,"
Carrie says, leaning forward to pick up a meatball with a toothpick.
"Really nice service. You've done him proud."
And Olive nods, because she would like Marlene to be comforted by this. But Marlene doesn't see Carrie. She's smiling upward, taking hold of someone's hand, and says,
"The kids planned it all."
And the hand belongs to Marlene's youngest girl, who in her blue velour jersey and navy blue skirt squeezes between Marlene and Carrie, putting her head on Marlene's shoulder, nestling her big girl's body close.
"Everyone's saying how nice the service was," Marlene says, smoothing the girl's long bangs away from her eyes. "You did a real nice job."
The girl nods, her head pressed against her mother's arm.
"Great job," says Carrie, tossing back the rest of the whiskey in her glass as though it were merely iced tea.
And Olive, watching all this, feels,
what,
jealousy? No, you don't feel jealous of a woman whose husband has been lost.
but an unreachability, that's how she'd put it. This plump, kind-natured woman sitting on the couch, surrounded by children, her cousin, friends, she is unreachable to Olive. Olive is aware of the disappointment this brings, because why, after all, did she come here today? Not just because Henry would have said to go to Ed Bonney's funeral. No, she came here hoping that, in the presence of someone else's sorrow, a tiny crack of light would somehow come through her own dark encasement. But it remained separate from her, this old house filled with people. Except one voice is beginning to rise above the others. Carrie Monroe is drunk. In her black suit, she stands by the couch and raises an arm. "Cop, Carrie," she says loudly. "Yep, that should have been me." Laughing, she sways. People say, "Watch it, Carrie. Careful there." And Carrie ends up sitting on the arm of the couch, slips a black high heel off, and flips it up and down her black stockinged foot. "Up against the wall, Buster." It's disgusting. Olive rises from her chair. Time to leave. Goodbyes aren't necessary. No one will miss her. The tide is going out. Near the shore, the water is flat, metal-colored, although out past Longway Rock, it's starting to get choppy. There's even a whitecap or two. Lobster boys down in the cove bob slightly, and seagulls circle the wharf near the marina. The sky is still blue, but off to the northeast, the horizon is lined with a rising cloud bank, and the tops of the pine trees are bending over there on Diamond Island. Olive is not able to leave after all. Her car is blocked in the driveway by other cars, and she would have to ask around and make a fuss, and she doesn't want to do that. So she has found herself a nice private spot, a wooden chair right below the deck, off to one corner, in which to sit and watch the clouds move in slowly over the bay. Eddie Jr. walks by on his way down to the shore with some of his cousins. They don't notice her sitting there, and they disappear down the skinny path between the bayberry bushes and the rugosa, and then reappear again on the shore, Eddie Jr. lagging behind the rest. Olive watches as he picks up stones and skips them through the water. Above her on the deck, she hears footsteps, big men's boot shoes, clump, clump. Matt Grierson's voice says in a long drawl, "Be a real high tide later tonight." "Yep," says someone else, Donnie Madden. "Marlene's going to get lonesome out here this winter," says Matt Grierson after a while. "Godfrey," thinks Olive from her chair below. "Run like hell, Marlene." Big flub-dub Matt Grierson.
"I guess she'll manage," answers Donnie eventually. "People do."
In another few minutes, their boots clump back inside. Olive hears the door close. "People manage," she thinks. It's true. But she takes a deep breath and has to shift her weight on this wooden chair because it's not true, too. She pictures Henry, not even a year ago, measuring what was needed for the mop boards in their new room, down on his hands and knees with the measuring tape, telling her the numbers while she wrote them down. Then Henry standing up, a tall man.
"Okay, Ollie, let's whittle the dogs and go into town."
The car ride. What did they talk about? Oh, how she wants to remember, but she can't remember. In town, in the parking lot of Shop and Save, because they needed milk and juice after they went to the lumber store, she said she would stay in the car. And that was the end of their life. Henry got out of the car and fell down. Never stood up again. Never walked down the pebble path to the house again. Never said an intelligible word again. Only sometimes those huge blue-green eyes would look at her from the hospital bed. Then he went blind. Now he will never see her again.
"Not much to look at these days," she's told him when she's gone to sit with him. "Lost a little weight now we don't have our crackers and cheese every night, but I guess I look like hell."
He would say that wasn't true. He would say,
Oh, no, Orly. You look wonderful to me.
He doesn't say anything. Some days in his wheelchair, he doesn't even turn his head. She makes the drive every day and sits with him.
You're a saint, says Molly Collins. God, how stupid can you be?
A scared old woman is what she is. All she knows these days is that when the sun goes down, it's time to go to bed.
People manage.
She's not so sure. The tide is still out on that one, she thinks.
Eddie Jr. has stayed down there on the shore, skipping stones. His cousins are gone. Just Eddie Jr. down there on the rocks alone, hurling those flat stones. Olive feels pleased by how good he is at this. Skip, 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 even though the water is no longer flat. She likes the way he immediately bends down, finding another, hurling that. But there's Carrie, and where did she come from? She must have gone down to the shore from around the other side of the house, because there she is in her stockinged feet on the rocks, veering over the barnacled rocks, calling out to Eddie. Whatever she's saying, he doesn't like. Olive can tell that from here. He keeps on skipping stones, but finally he turns to her and speaks. Carrie opens her arms in a kind of pleading gesture, and Eddie Jr. just shakes his head. And a few minutes later, Carrie comes back up from the shore, crawling up the rocks, clearly drunk. She could break her neck out there, Olive thinks. Not that Eddie Jr. seems to care. He throws a stone, real hard this time, too hard. It doesn't skip, just smashes into the water. For a long time, Olive sits there. She looks out over the water, and on the far edge of her mind, she can hear people getting into their cars, driving away. But she is thinking of Marlene Monroe, a young girl, so shy, walking home with her sweetheart, Ed Bonney. How happy a girl she must have been, standing at Crossbow Corners while the birds chirped, and Ed Bonney perhaps said, "Gee, I hate to say goodbye." They lived right here in this house, with Ed's mother, for the first years of their marriage until the old lady died. If Christopher had stayed married, his wife wouldn't have let Olive live with them for 5 minutes. And now Christopher was so different, he might not let her live with him either, should Henry die and she find herself in trouble. Christopher might stick her in the attic, except his California house didn't have an attic. Tie her to a flagpole, but he didn't have one. "So fascist," is what Christopher said the last time he was here, as they drove past the Bullock's house with the flag out front. Whoever went around saying things like that? A stumbling sound on the deck above her, and then a slurred voice. "I'm sorry, Marlene. Really, you have to believe me." And then the murmuring sounds of Marlene herself, telling Carrie it's time to go sleep it off. And after that, clumping sounds down the deck stairs, more silence. Back inside the house, Olive puts a brownie into her mouth and goes off to find the bathroom. Coming out, she runs into the woman with the long gray hair, who is right now sticking a cigarette butt into a potted plant that sits on a table in the hallway. "Who are you?" Olive says, and the woman stares at her. "Who are you?" the woman answers, and Olive walks past her. That is the woman who bought Christopher's house, Olive realizes with an inner lurch. That woman who hasn't the decency to respect even a poor potted plant, let alone everything Olive and Henry worked for, their son's beautiful house, where their grandchildren were going to grow up.
"Where's Marlene gone to?" Olive asks Molly Collins, who still has Marlene's apron on and is walking around the living room officiously collecting plates, balled up paper napkins. Molly looks over her shoulder and says vaguely,
"Gee, I'm not sure."
"Where's Marlene gone?"
Olive asks Susie Bradford, who comes by next, and Susie says,
"Around."
It's Eddie Jr. who tells her,
"Carrie got drunk and Mom's gone to put her in bed."
He says this with a dark look at the back of Susie Bradford,
and Olive likes the boy a good deal. She did not have this young fellow in school. She left teaching years before to tend to her own family, Christopher out in California, Henry over in Hashem at the home. Gone, gone, gone to hell. "Thank you," she says to Eddie Jr., who in his young eyes seems to have some awareness of hell himself. It is no longer a lovely April day. The northeast wind that blows against the side of the Bonney house has also brought the clouds in, and now a sky as gray as November hangs over the bay, and against the dark rocks the water slaps ceaselessly, swirling seaweed around, leaving it bumpily combed out along the higher rocks. Right down to the point, the rocky coastline looks barren, almost wintry. Only the skinny spruce and pine show dark green, for it is far too early for any leaves to come out. Even close to the house, the forsythia is only budded. Olive Kittredge, on her way to find Marlene, steps over a smashed-looking crocus by the garage's side door. Last week, after the day that was warm enough to take the dog to Henry in the parking lot, it snowed, one of those April dumpings of pure white that all melted the very next day. But the ground in places is still soggy from the assault, and certainly this crushed yellow crocus has been done in. The side door of the garage opens directly to stairs, and Olive walks up them cautiously, stands on the landing. Two sweatshirts are hanging on hooks. A pair of muddied yellow rubber boots stand side by side, toes facing in opposite directions. Olive knocks on the door, looking at the boots. She bends over and places one boot on the other side of its mate, so they look like they go together, could walk off together. And she knocks again. No answer, so she turns the knob, pushes the door open slowly, walks in.
Hello, Olive.
Across the room, facing her, Marlene sits like an obedient schoolgirl in a straight-backed chair by Carrie's double bed, her hands folded in her lap, her plump ankles crossed neatly. On the bed sprawls Carrie. She lies on her stomach with the abandonment of a sunbather, her face turned toward the wall, elbows out, but her hips are turned slightly, so that the black outline of her suit seems to accentuate the rise of her rear end, and her black stockinged legs are sleek, in spite of the fact that the stockings are shredded in a series of tiny runs at her feet. "Is she asleep?" Olive asks, walking farther into the room.
"Passed out," Marlene answers. "Upchucked first in Eddie's room, then fell asleep here."
"I see. Well, it's a nice place you've given her here."
Olive walks over toward the little dining alcove and brings back a chair, sits down by Marlene. For a while, neither woman speaks. Then Marlene says pleasantly,
"I've been thinking about killing Carrie."
She raises a hand from her lap and exposes a small paring knife lying on her green-flowered dress.
"Oh," says Olive.
Marlene bends over the sleeping Carrie and touches the woman's bare neck.
"Isn't this some major vein?"
she asks, and puts the knife flat against Carrie's neck, even poking slightly at the vague throbbing of the pulse there.
"Yeah, okay. Might want to be a little careful there."
Olive sits forward. In a moment, Marlene sighs, sits back.
"Okay. Here,"
and she hands the paring knife to Olive.
"Do better with a pillow," Olive tells her. "Cut her throat. There's going to be a lot of blood."
A sudden, soft, deep eruption of a giggle comes from Marlene.
"Never thought of a pillow."
"I've had some time to think about pillows," Olive says,
but Marlene nods vacantly, like she's really not listening.
"Mrs. Kittredge, did you know?"
"Know what?"
says Olive, but she feels her stomach turn choppy, white caps in her stomach.
"What Carrie told me today. She said it happened with her and Ed only once.
just one time. But I don't believe that. It had to be more. The summer after Ed Jr. graduated from high school.
Marlene has started to cry, is shaking her head. Olive looks away. A woman needs her privacy. She holds the paring knife in her lap and gazes out through the window above the bed. Only gray sky and gray ocean, too high up to see any shoreline. Only gray water and sky out there, far as the eye can see.
I never heard anything, says Olive. Why would she choose today to tell you?
Thought I knew.
Marlene has pulled a Kleenex from somewhere, from inside her sleeve, maybe, and she dabs at her face, blows her nose.
She thought I knew all along, and I was just punishing her by keeping on being nice to her. She got drunk today and started saying how good I got her, killing her and Ed with kindness that way.
Jism crow, is all Olive can think to say.
Isn't that funny, Olive?
Again, out of nowhere, comes Marlene's deep giggle.
Well, says Olive.